Welcome back.
We continue our conversation about the current conflict in Israel with Professor Atalia Omar. Professor Omar teaches religion, conflict, and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Atalia Omar, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you for having me.
In American public discourse, everything becomes too much, in my view, becomes linear. So one says I'm pro-Israel, I'm pro-Palestinian. So let's just start with the pro-Israel side. When you hear someone say pro-Israel, what's, in your view, missing from that critique when they say they're pro-Israel?
Yeah, I think that at the outset, I should really name my own situatedness. I'm Jewish.
Sure,
Israeli.
Please.
Yeah, I'm Jewish Israeli academic. I've been in American academy now for many years, but my research and everything that I do is connected back to Palestine, Israel. And so when I hear people say, oh, I'm pro-Israel, the way I hear it is that it has so many, there are so many assumptions that are unfolded into this statement. What does it mean to be pro-Israel? Often it's interpreted as the inability to even offer a critical engagement with Israeli policies, for instance. So if people encounter people like me, I'm again Jewish Israeli scholar who is deeply critical of Israeli policies, then somehow I'm not authentically Israeli. So it's a very, very reductive discourse that has certain presumptions that equate, as part of the discourse, it equates Israel with quote unquote dead Jews, which is kind of a fetishized construct. And so these are some of the issues that need to be interrogated and that are very, very reductive and don't let kind of space for fluidity and for internal contestation and really kind of builds into a fetishized account of Israel that is not necessarily good for Jewish Israelis and for Jewish people.
I'll pose the same question to you. When you hear the term pro-Palestinian, what are you hearing something similar, are you hearing something different?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar in the sense that, or it could be very similar in the sense that there are certain like assumptions about binaries. That if you say I'm pro-Palestinians, then it means somehow that you are against Jewish people, which goes it builds on the kind of assumptions that are that undergird the construct pro-Israel. And so if the if saying I'm pro-Palestinian means people, if people hear it as this is a statement against Jewish people, that's a deep problem. But often when I hear I'm pro-Palestine, I also hear because of my understanding of how mobilization around the dignity of Palestinians, Palestinian human rights, Palestinian political rights, how it connects to a broader and kind of understanding of humanity, of contesting the kind of erasure that Palestinian stories have been target for. Then I hear that when people say I'm pro-Palestinian, that they say I recognize the discourse that erases Palestinians, and I'm going to affirm Palestinian life, that Palestinian lives matter.
I pose this question to my previous guest. I want to pose it to you as well. Oftentimes, at least here in America, you hear the conflict between Israeli and Palestine equated to the situation South African apartheid. Is that an accurate comparison to you? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of evidence-based research. Of course, I mean, Palestinians spoke about, let me step back and say, well, first of all, apartheid, while it is, of course, a concept that is born out of the South African context, it's also a category in international law. It's a comparative category. And there is really kind of a mountain of evidence-based research. Palestinians spoken about their realities, the reality, especially in the West Bank, as qualifying as apartheid. for a long, long time, but it's important to note that in recent years there is a wave of reports by very respectable human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch, like Amnesty International, and also the Jewish Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, that show that indeed the concept, the category, this legal category of apartheid is relevant as a description of the realities in the entirety of the geopolitical space of historic Palestine, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. In fact, B'Tselem, the Jewish Israeli human rights organization, in their report, their apartheid report, also spoke about Jewish supremacy as really something that is relevant to describe the realities. And it manifests this. What does it mean, Jewish supremacy? It means that, well, first of all, Israel is sovereign across the geopolitical space of historic Palestine. It's sovereign in different ways. The report came out before the current assault on Gaza that the international the highest international court rendered as a plausible genocide. But there was, the siege on Gaza for 16 years, where Israel was the sovereign. So yeah, Jewish interests are prioritized over and against Palestinian interest. In the West Bank, you have a whole infrastructure of differentiated identification cards. You have bypass roads, roads only for Jews. You have Israeli citizens who carry the legal. They carry their citizenship on their bodies. They are settlers in the West Bank, and they are subject to different kind of law than the Palestinians, among which they kind of insert their settlements into. So you have two legal systems. What else can qualify as kind of an apartheid framework, where people are judged according to different laws and regulations?
It feels, at least to me, that and if we start, God, there's so many places we can start the historical timeline. But l so let's just start it with we'll start going from 1967 forward. In that period, it feels, at least to me, that this conflict has rested on two tiers. One tier is finding a short-term peace based on the most recent conflict. And the other term is the other tier is that long-term peace solution. Is it possible, in your view, to have both a short-term and a long-term peace solution, or is that just wishful thinking on those of us not involved in the conflict?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by the short term, but I think that what you alluded to, you want to say something about that?
No, I was going to say I'll just clarify. What I mean by
Yeah.
short term, let's take the present situation. So the short term would be, let's say, a ceasefire coming to some conclusion based on the October 7th events. If you reconcile that, you still have this long term peace conflict, peace solution that's still out there. Can you get can we is both are both possible is what I'm asking you.
Yeah, yeah, this is an important clarification. So with respect to how you kind of even frame the question by with the very astute recognition that it's really important, the question of periodization, where did it start? Where do we start the timeline is absolutely critical. So the for three decades since the 1993 Oslo Accords until September, which just a few weeks before October 7th happened, we had a process, the so-called peace process, which of course Palestinians have experienced as a different mechanism to entrench the violence, to entrench the occupation. And there was a very deep sense that it wasn't, that the quote-unquote peace process was not unfolding in good faith in on the part of Israelis, especially considering the fact that the settlement constructions continued and the possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state was no longer plausible. But it was, and some of the issues with respect to even the very kind of the basic framework of the peace discourse was that the occupation of 1967 in a sense normalized everything that happened before that the Nakba, what Palestinians experience as the the massive catastrophe, the destruction of about 500 communities, villages, the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians, the creation of the refugee, the first wave of Palestinian refugees. This is very much at the heart, and from a Palestinian perspective, peace with justice will have to address the Nakba. But putting that aside, for all those years, Palestinians came to terms with, or some Palestinians came to term with, okay, let's not go to the root causes that will really be, necessary to address in order to think about questions of justice. Let's agree on that quote unquote two-state framework that is beholden to what I call segregationist discourse, where you have, from an Israeli Jewish perspective, you have kind of the maintenance of that construct that is really falling under the weight of its own internal contradictions, the Jewish democracy within 1948 boundaries, and a separate state that is Palestinians. But as we spoke about it, that in and of itself, during the decades of the quote unquote peace process, was really the facts on the ground really worked against that kind of possibility. So, what many Palestinians realize in recent years, and the discourse, kind of the discourse within Palestinian space has really shifted, is that that another kind of paradigm needs to be to be articulated, that is about defragmentation of the Palestinians in 48, in 67, in Gaza, in the diasporas, and in exile. And so you have that kind of mobilization and the delegitimization of the Palestinian Authority that came into being as a result of the Oslo Accords. And so there is a sense that the actual root causes need to be addressed. At the current moment, yes, ceasefire is absolute, the absolute minimal threshold to even start big. Even start talking about longer term sustainable options that will have to involve revitalization of kind of Palestinian democratic ability to democratically elect their own kind of and articulate their own visions of peace and justice. So what I'm saying here is that it's really important to and again, I'm speaking as from my own positionality as Jewish Israeli, who has interrogated now for many years the kind of assumptions about what peace is, what justice is, in reference to this case. It's very important to not have that to center Palestinian voices in this kind of conversation. But ceasefire, what you call the immediate, is absolutely, critical because of the massive level of destruction, of course, in Gaza, but also under the fog of the assault on Gaza. There is ongoing and really escalation of the assault on Palestinian communities in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem too.
You mentioned two items in your last answer. I'd like to have you just expand on and just give a historical definition to. You mentioned Oslo, and then you mentioned the settlements. Could you talk about both of those, what they are in the historical framework of this conflict?
Yes. So the Oslo Accords, I'm referring to the US coordinated and also Oslo, because it was also because a Norwegian team was very central in facilitating the initial secret negotiations between the PLO and representatives from Jewish Israeli society. So those Oslo Accords that were signed at the beginning of signing of a series of accords was 1993, a very, very famous image in the White House with Bill Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin, the time Israeli Prime Minister, who was shortly after assassinated by a religious as a religious Israeli Jew. As a result of massive incitement that was very much kind of propelled by the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was very central to the kind of incitement that happened around the time that then led to the assassination of Rabin, and Yasser Arafat, who was the leader of the PLO, of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. At the time of the secret negotiations, the PLO was in exile, was in Tunisia, and was really terribly weakened as a result of a series of events, and especially most recently before, prior to the Oslo Accords and the Oslo negotiations, the expulsion from Lebanon during the Israeli invasion to Lebanon in 1982. Now, what is interesting is that, and it's often forgotten or omitted from narratives about the kind of the moment of the Oslo, is that after the expulsion of the PLO from the 19 from Lebanon to Tunisia and its weakening. Shortly after, in 1987, you see the emergence in the West Bank of a grassroots really resistance called the Intifada, or moment of which means uprising or shaking off. So that's the first Intifada in 1987. It emerged. It was a grassroots movement. It was mostly nonviolent. Many Palestinians who experienced were a part of it really experienced it as a moment of it's a popular resistance, real empowerment. You have kind of grassroots leadership again emerging from the ground up, and that eventually led the first Intifada because it was really broadly televised, and all of a sudden, and kind of the iconic image of the Intifada, of the first Intifada, was of the children throwing stones against the tanks. So you have kind of like a subversion of a narrative, especially as it represented in American media. Of David and Goliath. And that led eventually to the Madrid multilateral negotiations, where the leadership, the local leadership, the grassroots leadership that emerged in the West Bank, in the absence of kind of a strong leadership in exile, the PLO, as I said, had been significantly weakened prior. So you had the local leadership, the grassroots leadership being a part of the negotiation of the Madrid. But then all of a sudden, that whole negotiation that was going to gain much more actually concessions in terms of from the Israelis, all of a sudden these negotiations were completely bypassed with the secret negotiations that had happened in Oslo. So the Oslo Accords was always was just kind of like a framework of agreements that meant to put in place some mechanism for an eventual Palestinian sovereign state to come about. Now in hindsight, especially as I said, we mark kind of the 30-year anniversary right prior to October 7th, and there were many kind of interrogation and reflections of all the many, many flaws of the Oslo frameworks in terms of the lack of real assurances of timeline of that idea of a sovereign state, and all the hard issues were kind of postponed to sometime in the future, and those hard issues were primarily the return of the refugees from 1948, and basically the right of return of Palestinians, and the status of Jerusalem as a potential capital of the future Palestinian state. And as part of the Oslo framework, and that goes also to your question about the kind of the apartheid, the earlier apartheid question, as part of the Oslo framework, you had the West Bank was kind of like broken up into different areas. It's very confusing. So there are three different areas: Area A, Area B, and Area C. Area A were immediately under kind of basically Palestinian autonomy. So this is where you have in Ramallah is became the seat of the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was established as a temporary body, again, so presumably leading, well, it will lead up to to a fully sovereign Palestinian state. But as many things in the context of Palestine, Israel, things that are temporary become permanent. And so we have the establishment of the Palestinian Authority. Area B is under kind of some sort of like collaboration of the Palestinian Authority of the PA and Israeli authorities, and Area C of the West Bank, which is over 60% of the West Bank, is under Israeli control. And Area C has become kind of a key site of the continuous settlement project, meaning a building of what is, according to international law, illegal. Why is it illegal according to international law? It's a violation of the Geneva Convention, where occupied country cannot transfer population from its from the home country to the occupied territory. So it's a violation of Geneva Convention from the perspective of international law. But successive governments, Israeli government, regardless of where they are located on the political spectrum, continue to build settlements to that kind of ate into the West Bank, and especially Area C. You see kind of a very systematic pattern of creating settlements that break into Palestinian spaces, kind of break the contiguity or the potential contiguity of Palestinian space. The ability to move, for Palestinians to move from one place to another place, has become over the years, over the 30 years of the Oslo framework, harder and harder and harder. And so, and presumably in the narrative, the settlement project in the West Bank was driven by Messianic Jews who were, deeply religious, understood their kind of the commandment to settle the land as something that will go over and above all the other commandments. They understood the time as extraordinary, as Messianic time. But in reality, the settlement project would have not been, successful and effective without the kind of infrastructure that the quote-unquote secular Israeli government has enabled over the years, including, what to refer back to the earlier issue, bypass roads that enable people, settlers in the occupied territories of 67, to basically not see Palestinian communities, to bypass them on roads that are only for Jews.
Professor Talia Omer, Notre Dame University, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on the Public Rally. It's been great to have you on, but we'll have to have you back. And I have a feeling this conflict will not be over anytime soon.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this conversation.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can also listen on an app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.